Let's take our Bibles and turn to Daniel chapter 5. Daniel chapter 5. This week, as I was preparing for the message, I couldn't help but notice Belshazzar is introduced in chapter 5, and his story begins and ends in chapter 5. Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom comes to an end in chapter 5. And I remember as I was reading through the passage, there was a statement that was in the back of my mind that just leapt forward, just a great summary of what it looks like from our perspective in Daniel chapter 5. And it was this: one strike and you're out. Strikes and outs. What do you think we're dealing with there? What is that the language of?
Baseball.
I want you to know that I decided to try to root out or go down the rabbit hole to find out the origin of this statement. One strike and you're out. Seems to be that I've heard it used lots of times in dealing with children. They would throw up. Wait a minute. You're telling me I'm already out? This is just the first time. It's not fair. I remember hearing that time after time after time again, and it's usually used in an appeal for compassion. So I decided to get down to the nuts and the bolts to find out where this phrase comes from, and I was actually surprised where and how one strike and you're out came part of at least my vernacular. You'd be surprised to know that way back in the 1990s, that phrase traces back. And it's not have anything to do with baseball, Brother Clifton. As a matter of fact, it dates back to the Clinton administration. Back in the days when Al Gore was inventing the internet, the Housing Authority had a program where they were trying to eliminate people living in government housing and committing crimes, criminal activity, using the public housing for selling illegal drugs and illegal activity. And there was a zero tolerance policy that was called the one strike and you're out. I was surprised that it went back just a few years, it seems. I think the problem that I have with the one strike and you're out isn't necessarily the rule. The one strike and you're out. Because if you knew that there were one strike and you're out, that's fine. Because in baseball, how many strikes do you have, Brother Clifton?
Three.
You've got three strikes. You get up to bat, you've got three strikes, you've got three attempts to hit the ball. Well, actually, no, you've got more than three attempts. You could be at the plate for quite a while as we're going to look. And I realize that baseball is going to help us understand the concept in just a moment. But really what we're dealing with is the balance between fairness and justice. That's the idea that we seem to be struggling with, especially in Daniel chapter 5. Not that it's not fair and not that it's not just. But when you stop to consider, when you look at what grace looks like, what mercy looks like, and how to have a compassionate heart for people, how long-suffering should we be? Do you think that one strike and you're out seems to be very long-suffering? Does it seem to be very fair, or does it seem to be very just? Well, let's define the normal uses of the words fair and just. The word fair means in accordance with the rules. If you can play by the rules, then you are playing fairly. What's the one thing that you holler at your television when you're watching a sport, when you're watching a sporting game and an umpire makes a call? What do you hear? I know, Brother Clifton, probably in your house, there's probably been lots of, that's not fair. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the umpire's supposed to be watching the rules, and if someone is not playing by the rules, then they are not playing fairly. But there's a problem with fairness. Because when you look at fairness, or when you consider fairness, you have within the bounds of playing according to the rules the opportunity to exploit loopholes. People do it all the time. We call that gaming the system. Now, fairness deals with just playing according to the rules, but just is playing by the rules morally right, in a morally correct and appropriate to the rules fashion. So when we say that God is fair and just, we mean that God does not violate his rules, but that he does so morally right. Fairness, justice. How would you like to reevaluate the scale that we often cry out? I remember the very first time that I heard the distinction between it. I was in Spanish class in high school. We had a test that was announced. The teacher explained to us everything that was going to be on the test. As we prepared for the test, everyone in the class failed the test. And I remember as the teacher passed out, and she was very disappointed. Well, she didn't pass out. She passed out the test. As the teacher passed out the test, she was very disappointed. And she asked us, where do we even start? And I remember someone in the back of the classroom said, "This isn't fair." And for the next 20 minutes, I received a lecture on the difference between fairness and justice. This idea of the battle between fairness and justice for me even goes back before the 90s when we were thinking about the one strike and you're out, I guess, if you're going to consider that. But really, to understand the picture, let's look at baseball again and talk about the rules of the game. These are for those of you who may not be familiar with baseball, at least you have some basic understanding. Every batter gets how many strikes? 3 strikes. How many balls do you get? And a ball, meaning not that a ball is thrown at you, but if it's not a strike and it's not a hit, if it is not thrown in the strike zone, then it's something that doesn't count against you. And if you get 4 balls, Brother Clifton, what happens? You get to walk to a base. Is that fair? Of course it is. It's because that's what the rule is. 3 strikes and you're out. 4 balls and you walk. But there's something called the infield fly rule. And I was thinking about the infield fly rule, which kind of mucks something up. Because if you hit a ball straight up in the air and it stays in the infield, you are considered out before you even get to the base if the ball could be caught but isn't caught. It doesn't have to necessarily be caught in order for you to be out. And I didn't think that was fair until I read the idea behind the infield fly rule. This is it. If a player sees a fly ball popped up in the infield and he has an opportunity to get it, but he looks around the bases and he realizes, if I catch this ball, it's going to be one out. But if I drop the ball, I've got time to pick it up, throw it to every base. I can get a double or I can get a triple play out off of this one ball that was hit in the air. And the infield fly rule was set up so that baseball could be hard and challenging to follow, and so that you know that rather than you getting 3 outs because you hit a ball, you get 1 out because you hit a ball. Now, when you hit it out to the outfield and it's thrown in and they get a triple play off of that, that's really amazing to see that happen. But the rules are fair when they're applied, when we look at the way the rules are. There was something that was surprising to me to consider an automatic strike, and not that it's surprising, it's just that the idea behind it, an automatic strike. Have you ever felt like the system was stacked against you and you were just, you came to the batter's box already, so to speak, you come to the batter's box, you already got this deck stacked against you, it always feels like everyone's against you, you've got an automatic strike about you. What is that about in baseball? An automatic strike in baseball happens when you're not standing inside the batter's box when the ball is thrown to the plate. You step outside of the bounds of the small little area there where the batter and the umpire and the catcher are standing. If you step out of the box, it's an automatic strike. If you are not in the batter's box when the ball is thrown, you get an automatic strike. And I think this is a good one. It's an automatic strike if when you swing, you hit the catcher. That sounds like a fair rule, right? Nobody wants to get hit. Everybody should stay inside the bounds, and you shouldn't jump out of the bounds in order to get out of getting a strike. So there are such things as automatic strikes. Is that fair? Of course it is. It's part of the rules. But as we look at the rules of baseball, there's also an opportunity to get thrown out of the game. Isn't that exciting to watch someone getting thrown out of the game? That's why we watch the races, because we like to see the wrecks. That's why we watch the hockey games, because we like to see the fights. No, that's not the right reason to watch those games, because it's unsportsmanlike to see people behave in an inappropriate manner. But you can get thrown out of the game of baseball, get this, not just for a few reasons, but for a number of reasons. For unsportsmanship-like conduct. If you are acting out of character for the game, if you are throwing a temper tantrum, or you're being mean, or you're hurling ugly words at the umpire, at the other team, at the fans, you can get thrown out of the game for conduct unbecoming a sportsman. You can get thrown out of the game for arguing with an umpire. You can get thrown out of the game if you put your hand on an umpire. You can get thrown out of the game if you leave the dugout. That's usually when the fight breaks out. You get thrown out of the game if you're using an illegal substance, something on your bat in order to give you an advantage in a hit, or something on a ball in order to make it harder to hit or to catch. Or you get thrown out for intentionally causing a delay of game. That's a lot of things to keep up with. Think about the poor children that get started out in Little League. No one sits down and tells them, okay, these are all the rules. They learn them the hard way. The first time they get a strikeout, it stings. Next time they go to bat, maybe they get to hit. But every time they hit a strike, that's just playing by the rules. Now, it's fair in terms of fair use to exploit a loophole. People do this with their taxes. People do this with the system. I think we know best about this when we look at the speed limits. Can you tell me what the loophole is for the speed limit? Anybody in here? This is for our radio listeners today, for those who are connected online. We just want to make sure that there's just a solidarity. Anybody have an idea of how fast you can go over the speed limit? Anybody know that one? Anybody willing to speak out in church? You know, you want to hold on to that one. I remember a few years ago, someone sit in the back of the room came to me and told me that it was 9 miles over the speed limit. And he happened to be driving down in Myrtle Beach, and a police officer pulled him over, and he says, I happen to know you don't have the authority to stop me because I was only going 9 miles over the speed limit, not 10. That would be breaking the law. And the state trooper said, I have the authority to pull you over if you're driving half a mile over the speed limit. Because the speed limit is the speed limit, and I'm going to give you a ticket to show you that I have that power. So beware those loopholes that you think that are there. And just do right. Justice deals with doing right, fairness, playing by the rules, but sometimes there's loopholes. I'd like to look at Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 4. He is the rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are judgment, a God of truth and without iniquity. Just and right is he. Is God just? Is God right? Does God act justly? Does God act rightly? He will never violate his character. He will never violate his word. So when we consider fairness and justice, something's going to happen. There's going to be a new pressure on that scale when you introduce the discussion of grace and mercy. If fairness is playing by the rules, if you do this, this is the consequence. We understand that's fair when you get what you deserve. We understand that when you transgress the law and you experience judgments for breaking the law, that is justice being served. So where in all of this discussion is there room for grace and mercy? I would like us to look at someone who's seemingly received a lot of stripes before judgment comes, or at least in the context of the story of Lot escaping judgment in Genesis chapter 18. You remember the story of Sodom and Gomorrah's destruction, how the Lord sends two visitors to come visit Abraham. I'm not dealing with so much the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah as I am looking at what God does on his way to Sodom and Gomorrah when he sends the two angels to stop by Abraham, and God reveals to Abraham his intentions. In doing so, we see Abraham's prayer. By the way, this is the first time that someone in the scriptures initiates a conversation with God. Not that God, we see in the garden when Adam and Eve, and when Adam talked with God, we see that. But this is Abraham praying to God. And you have to back off. If you read Genesis chapter 18, verse 23, it looks like Abraham's being forward, but you see his heart. It's a lot like it's supposed to be. A heart that's right, that's burdened and broken for others. Look with me in Genesis chapter 18, verse 23. And Abraham drew near and said, "Wilt thou also destroy the righteous with the wicked?" Stop right there. God's going to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah as his plan was revealed to Abraham. And Abraham says, "God, wait a minute. You're going to destroy the righteous people living in Sodom and Gomorrah alongside of the wicked? Is there anybody that is confused that a lawbreaker being called to justice, that seems to be fair, right? But someone who did not break the law, how in the world can that be fair? How in the world can that be right?" Verse 24, "Peradventure there be 50 righteous people within the city. Wilt thou also destroy and not spare the place for 50 righteous that are therein? That be far from thee to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked, and that the righteous should be as the wicked. That be far from thee. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" And from Abraham's perspective, Abraham knows something about Sodom and Gomorrah. Sure, he's probably heard the stories and knows about the wickedness going on in the valley that's going to bring down God's judgment. But he has his nephew Lot, who lives in the city. And he knows that if God destroys the city, God's going to destroy Lot. And surely there's got to be 50 people that are righteous inside the city walls. And what does God say? Okay. If you can find 50 people, I'll spare the city. Abraham thinking, that may be tough. How about we say 40, God? God says, okay, you can find 40. Abraham says, well, God, what about 30? And God says, okay, 30 people. 20? Okay. But they stop at 10. 10 people who are righteous in the city walls. Surely you could find 10 righteous people inside the city walls, right? But 10 could not be found. We find in the story that there are 4 people that are going to escape judgment inside the city. Wait a minute, one of them looked back. There are 3 people inside the city walls that escape judgment. Lot and his 2 daughters. God reveals his character in his justice. Genesis chapter 19, the next verse we see, "And it came to pass when God destroyed the cities of the plain that God remembered Abraham, and he sent Lot out of the midst of them out of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot dwelt. Something amazing happens here. Amazing grace. Lot was in the city. God had sent his messengers to the city to evaluate the city. Abraham was going to go and look for 10 righteous people to save the city. And Abraham prays to God and says, God, won't you spare the city, knowing full well that judgment would come to his loved one. We see God's character in bringing to pass what he says he will do, he does. Because our God is a promise-keeping God. He means what he says. He does what he says. And he is right, and he is just. But we also see grace, mercy, his fairness, and his justice. If we will look back at Genesis chapter 18, just a few verses before Abraham asks the Lord about 50, 40, 30, 20, 10. Genesis 18, verse 17. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do? Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I know that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. We don't think about it in these terms, but God revealing to Abraham that he's going to destroy these cities for their wickedness is also going to be an assurance to Abraham that what God has promised him is going to come to pass. As far as his plans for Abraham, as far as his plan for Abraham's descendants, and the importance of Abraham and his descendants not living lives of wickedness and debauchery, but to live righteously and justly. Verse 20, and the Lord said, because of the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done according to the cry of it, which is come unto me, and if not, I will know. Wait a minute. Surely God has to know about everything that's going on, but in his grace and in his mercy and in his fairness and his justice, he sent these two messengers to go into the city to see the state. And along the way, he stops by Abraham, revealing his intentions with a fulfillment promise for Abraham. Abraham, when you see this happen, you know that I am a covenant-keeping God. And Abraham, when you see this come to pass, you know that this is what I say is to be for your people, to live righteously and justly and not wickedly. And I'm going to go down and I'm going to see whether or not what everyone says about the city is true. I think we see something rhetorically. I think the Lord knows exactly what's going on. But in fairness, he's giving just one more, bear with me, strike opportunity against the city. As we've been working through this series, as we consider this morning the dream we realize would be to escape judgment, as we see in Lot's case. But we're in Daniel chapter 5 now, finally, and we will see the dream turn into a nightmare. And the nightmare is when I receive everything that I deserve, as Belshazzar finds out. Our point this morning is this: justice is certain. Let's go to the Lord in prayer and ask him to bless our time together. Lord, we thank you so much for your holy word and for your holy heart. You are righteous, you are just, but you are gracious and you are merciful. And God, while we can't always reconcile those tensions, they are perfectly summed up in your Son, Jesus. And I pray, Lord, that today we would see your Son, even through the message of Daniel chapter 5, that your grace is sufficient. And the beauty of who you are so perfectly captured in the beauty of your Son, Jesus. Lord, we need you now. Give us ears to hear, hearts to change, and a desire to see that change spill out of our lives and flow into the lives of those whom our lives touch. We ask these things in your name. Amen. Daniel chapter 5 is the famous section with the handwriting on the wall. Incidentally, the origin of that story, Daniel chapter 5. That expression literally happens here in Daniel chapter 5. Look with me in verse 1. Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Belshazzar's, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem. And the king and his princes and his wives and his concubines might drink therein. Those artifacts that were taken from the temple. He's wanting to flaunt his power, and he's wanting them to be brought down to the feast to let his partygoers drink out of those furnishings that were taken from the temple. Now, they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple, out of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem, and the king and the princes and his wives and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine, and they praised the gods of gold and of silver and of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. And in the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand, which wrote against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. That was not the wine talking. That was a visitation of justice, as we are going to see, from the Lord. Nebuchadnezzar learned the hard way whom God was. Belshazzar has forgotten every lesson that was learned in the past. He doesn't know where to go. He doesn't know what's happening. There was something scribbled on the wall, and there's no one that can answer, no one that can tell him what this means. And it had nothing to do with the wine being messed up or funky. That they were seeing something through intoxicated eyes. This was something that was apparent. There was a message that was left, and only one person in all of the kingdom could explain the meaning of this sight. Daniel chapter 5, verse 10. Now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house. And the queen spake and said, O king, live forever. Let not thy thoughts trouble thee. Let not thy countenance be changed. There is a man in thy kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him. Who the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, the king, I say, thy father made master of the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. Who's he talking about? Daniel. For as much is a man in thy kingdom, in whom the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of thy father. For as much as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpreting the dreams and showing the hard sentences and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, whom the now let Daniel be called, and we will show the interpretation. She lays it out on the table. Remember back to Daniel chapter 1 and chapter 2 when the king had the dream and Daniel interpreted it. He did something amazing. And he was appointed as a ruler over the under the king. And then that weird event that happens when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to bow the knee, and they were cast in the fiery furnace, and they were rescued from it. There was a fourth man in the fire with them. And they, too, were appointed to an elevated portion in the kingdom. And then remember when your dad had that other dream about the statue that came up that was knocked down by the stone? Remember that, how that Daniel was able to tell the king what would happen? in the dream, that's what got Daniel to the position, but that the king had another dream about the tree that came up and it was cut down, and that the king went mad for that season. This Daniel has keep coming up and keep coming up. Why don't we call on Daniel? The king is so far removed from the lessons of the past that he doesn't even know where to turn. He went to the soothsayers and the astrologers and the Chaldeans, the same usual suspects. I mean, we already know that as far as his view of the Lord, he's making a mockery with the furnishings that were taken from the temple. He's got his heart that's set in the gods of the kingdom. He's not really thinking in terms of the lessons that his dad learned. He's just thinking about what in the world's going on here. And it would be no one that could give him an answer but Daniel. Daniel chapter 5, verse 16. And I heard of these that thou canst make interpretation and dissolve doubts. Now if thou canst read the writing and make it known to me, the interpretation thereof, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold around thy neck, and thou shalt be the third ruler in the kingdom. And then Daniel answered, said before the king, let thy gifts be to thyself, and give thy rewards to another, yet I will read the writing unto the king, and make known unto him the interpretation. This is Daniel has been here time and time again. He's going to get a promotion through delivering some bad news. But the lessons of the past should not be forgotten in the present. Everything that Nebuchadnezzar learned the hard way and that Belshazzar witnessed living in his father's house, he had to have seen it. He had to have known. There was that period of time where his father was out of the house and living out in the fields bad with the hair that was like feathers and the claws that were like a beast claws. Something that Belshazzar needs to know also is that he did not build this kingdom. As Daniel starts to set Belshazzar straight in verse 18, O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and language trembled and feared before him, whom he would have slew and whom he would have kept alive and whom he would set up and whom he would put down. It was God that certified Nebuchadnezzar's authority. Why in the world would God use an imperfect man like Nebuchadnezzar in the world at that time? You and I don't have the eternal perspective that God has. But we do, and we see clearly from scriptures, that God sets whom he will set up. And God appoints kings. And the question that we have in this passage here isn't how in the world Belshazzar is successfully reigning and ruling in his kingdom. The point is that the power that was vested in your father and the tremendous responsibility and the way that this kingdom has operated in existence is because God, not necessarily blessing you in your wickedness, but withholding his judgment in your wickedness. But when his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, he was disposed from his kingly throne and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men and his heart was made like the beasts and his dwelling was with the wild asses and they fed with the grass and the oxen and his body was wet with the dew of heaven till they knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men and that he appointed over it whomsoever he will. And everything that happened to your father was an object lesson for people to see who is really in charge. The strike one for Belshazzar is that he saw firsthand, but he did not care. Verse 22, and this his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all of this. I don't know if Daniel was standing up there with really defiance against the king. I think he's just setting it straight. You watched and you saw and you had every opportunity to learn and yet you did nothing with it. But hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven And they have brought the vessels of this house before thee, and thou and thy lords and thy wives and thy concubines have drunk wine in them, and thou hast praised the God of silver and of gold and of brass and of iron and wood and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know, and the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose all thy ways hast thou not glorified. Do you read there that it was the drinking from the temple hardware, that's where the strike was? Or was it something much bigger? What he was doing with the gold that was taken from the temple is really indicative of what's going on in here, or what's not going on in here, I should say. And that we see the first strike, the handwriting on the wall, the first strike isn't really the first strike, but it is the last straw. And the words that were written upon the wall, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin, are interpreted as this. Verse 26, this is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God has numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. Perez, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And we hear that, the handwriting on the wall. Your days are numbered. You've been found lacking. The scales have tipped in the wrong way because of your behavior. And there is judgment that is coming. And it's going to be, your kingdom is going to be given to the Medes and the Persians. Which goes back to that dream that his father had about the statue, about the kingdom that would come and would be split in two. The kingdom to come after Nebuchadnezzar's reign. That judgment didn't come in Nebuchadnezzar's lifetime. I wonder if people forgot. People said, you know, it didn't come to pass, so we've got plenty of time. But we remember that we're still dealing with Nebuchadnezzar's family line, and his kingdom through his son is going to come crashing down here. And that the table was already set, and the story was already told about judgment coming. And what does Belshazzar do? He appoints Daniel prince for a day, literally. Then commanded Belshazzar in verse 29, they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck, and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Verse 30, in that night was Belshazzar the king of the Chaldeans slain. And Darius the Median took the kingdom, and being about 62 years old, the handwriting was on the wall. The judgment was announced. The judgment was swift. Belshazzar has fallen, and Darius now has the throne. And if we read Daniel chapter 5, it looks like Belshazzar, you got one strike and you're out. But that's not really the case at all. Because he saw his father humbled firsthand, and yet he took nothing away from it. He did not see what his father saw. How that time and time again, Nebuchadnezzar makes an important statement about Daniel's God and the power of Daniel's God. And Belshazzar doesn't see it at all. And he rejects the truth. Strike one, strike two, strike three. I think if we start counting backwards, it's amazing how many strikes we'll actually find. And not so much that these are bad calls, but we realize there was opportunity after opportunity after opportunity. Look back with me at verse 4. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver and of brass and of iron and of wood and of stone. His heart was so wrapped up in idolatry. We have in Belshazzar someone who does not see what his father saw. He rejects the truth and celebrates in the practices of his kingdom and thinks he's invincible. And he knew that judgment was coming,
because of the handwriting on the wall.
Was the handwriting on the wall the act of judgment, or was it the act of grace and mercy? For when a king falls, and people could just say, well, why did that happen? We don't know. It's sad. But that he knew exactly what he was accountable for, and he knew that judgment had come. As we close the service this morning, the point is this: please receive Jesus' grace while you still may. Yes. Yes. Belshazzar had opportunity. Yes, Belshazzar could see the same lessons that his father knew, but he didn't. And when judgment came, it was swift. And Jesus Christ, when you consider the cross, we see God's justice and his wrath made and placed upon Jesus, who took our sins and bore our sins. Is that fair? God didn't break his rules. He knew that the price that sin must require. And Jesus paid that price. Was God just in condemning his son to die on our behalf? Yes, he is. And he's merciful. And he's gracious. And the beautiful message of the gospel of Jesus, the death, the burial, and the resurrection, remind us that it is not you, but God who has transgressed and paid the price. And it was Jesus who paid your price and paid mine. And that while the message seems so clear to us that believe, he did this for me because my sins put him there, and he received the judgment that I deserved in grace through faith. He saves us. So receive Jesus' grace while you may. And if you've received that grace, I have a petition for you to have a heart like Abraham. Remember our point this morning: justice is certain. We need to learn to reject Babylon's values. It got Belshazzar nowhere, but actually hastened the judgment. And yes, lots of times people love to go out and love to try to enjoy the pleasures of the sin of this world. And the pleasures of the sin of this world only last but a season. You live with the consequences and the misery and the pain and the heartache. People have tried it for generations. Throughout our history of humanity, people have lived apart from God, seeking their happiness and their satisfaction apart from him. But the ones who have put their faith and trust in him see the beauty and the joy and the hope that is only in Jesus. Reject Babylon's values and make up your mind about what is right. Making up your mind about right, what is right, it's not looking for those loopholes. It's learning to see what God says is right. We find that in his holy word. His scriptures are clear and plain. And like Abraham, who had a heart for his loved ones, when he heard that judgment was coming, may this message this morning reaffirm for us the importance and the urgency of praying like Abraham did for their behalf, for the people whose lives our lives touch, and sharing the message of hope with those people who need to hear the message of hope. The message of hope. It is to the lost and a comfort to the redeemed. For he saved me, just as he saved you. And there's still power in the blood of Jesus. It will never lose its power. And in his grace and in his mercy, he laid down his life to pay sin's price. Don't fall away. Stay the course. Our prayer as we close is this: Lord, may your mercy and grace cover me and those whom I see need you.